Good evening. I'm Nancy Nangeroni, and this is Gender Talk. Hello again, this is Gender Talk, Boston's worldwide radio show that talks about transgenderism in the first person. Each week we bring you news, information, and exciting new voices that challenge our traditional view of gender. Tonight we're going to spend some quality time at the intersection of gender and ecology. Our guest will be a remarkable woman who is considered one of the world's most influential theoretical ecologists. She's director of the Earth Systems Program at Stanford University. Her name is Joan Roughgarden, and we'll talk with Joan about herself, her candidacy for the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, and all about ecology and how it relates to ourselves, our lives, and maybe even our gender. And because our local ecology is lively and varied, we'll also have the Twisted Nasty News, Question of the Week, and much more tonight on Gender Talk. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another week of Gender Talk.
Yes.
Hey, Hal.
Hi there.
I'm Nancy Nangeroni.
And I'm Gordine McKenzie.
And it's time for another 90 minutes of that show we all love to hate, right? No, not exactly. How are you doing, Karen?
I'm here. So, since you guys aren't here anymore, you don't get to see my Gender Talk dance at the beginning of the show.
Describe it.
You know, with my arms waving and my feet tapping.
I saw you there in spirit, girl.
Okay.
It's a marvel to behold.
It is.
That's one of the disadvantages of doing the radio show this way, I will say, Karen. What a shame. So did you guys watch the inauguration?
Nope.
I did.
Did you? What'd you think?
I thought that it was a good speech. It was full of all sorts of wonderful, warm and fuzzy platitudes.
Aphorisms, yeah.
Yeah, the angel riding the whirlwind.
Somehow
I had not yet begun to play with that speech.
Somehow I got the sense, listening to him talk, that that was as deep as he went. That he had those principles that he talked about. You know, we face adversity overseas with resolve or whatever it is. Somehow I got the impression that when a problem occurs, like, that's the extent of his internal resources for dealing with these problems. That
I think that's it. He's got his father and his vice president to run things.
Yeah, to really deal with the complexity of the issues out there.
Well, it's going to be another corporate presidency, much like Reagan, I think, because we're not talking about someone who has a lot of original thoughts.
Now, one of the things I noticed, I watched a rebroadcast of his speech last night, happened to catch it, and one of the things I noticed is it seemed to me the applause was quite tepid. What did you guys think? I mean, then after they showed his inauguration speech, this is on C-SPAN, which has turned out to be a great source for this sort of thing. After they showed his speech, they went to a speech that Clinton gave, a sort of farewell speech to a group of admirers and all, and when Clinton spoke, people stomped and shouted and whistled and made a tremendous noise. When Bush gave his little inauguration speech, he would pause for applause, and there'd be a noticeable lag before people actually started.
Like people holding up the signs. Okay, applaud now.
Yeah, it was like people didn't, you know, weren't very enthused or didn't seem it.
Or it was like those for sale signs. It was like, did that go over? Did that sell? Am I gonna get rewarded for it?
Yeah. Did you guys notice on C-SPAN the coverage of the inauguration parade? They did show the signs that protesters were holding up along the route.
I was watching ABC, and the only thing you saw was one sign for NOW, the National Organization of Women.
Oh, really?
There are great signs.
Well, C-SPAN was better.
Yeah. Yeah. C-SPAN's and a lot of people just had for sale signs, like people use on houses.
Government for sale.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
So somebody egged his limo.
Yeah, we heard about that. Let's talk about that. Somebody threw an egg at his limo?
During the parade. When he got to the section where all, you know, the demonstrators were, somebody egged his car.
Did they actually hit it?
Yeah, and so they had to speed up. They wanted to get him out of there. They speed up, and then the Secret Service guys had to run to keep up.
Yeah, I taped that so my students could watch
it. Now, is this a historical first? Is this the first time that a presidential limo has been egged?
I sincerely doubt it.
I'll bet it is in the inauguration. Mm. Well, maybe not. Maybe years past. Maybe maybe before the Secret Service got as powerful and before they called out the military to...
Powerful. You know, it's such a gendered event. There were some female Secret Service agents, but overall you have these big G.I. Joe, very buffed bodies running down the street next to these black cars and the military following. And then you see the wives in kind of, you know, a little demure blue and these little black high heels.
But they were all dressed up. You must love that aspect of it. Everyone was commenting how flashy everybody was dressed up.
And you mean for the actual...
For all the balls and stuff.
For the balls.
One of the best inaugural parade outfits was Jacqueline Kennedy's little pink outfit.
Oh, yeah?
That actually got destroyed, but...
What do you mean?
You're talking about Jackie O.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, it wasn't inaugural. It was some kind of parade in Texas or something.
That was the assassination.
Oh, you're talking about the assassination.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's an interesting
very
connection. Yeah.
Yeah. Well.
Well, and a lot of people were complaining too about the amount of money that was spent. Some of my students were saying today that it seemed really intense because they were going, well, and we're giving $200 pens and glass bowls and all these things, and then they'd hear something on the news about, and people in Russia are starving and their toes are falling off because they're freezing, and then they talk about all these souvenirs for
that. Sounds like my mother though, when I was growing up. But, you know, there's people starving in China. Eat your food. You know, it's a limit to how far that argument takes you. You know, it's like there's definitely a problem between the haves and the have-nots. No question about that. And maybe, I guess this just makes it more obvious when you have so many of the haves gathered together in such opulent splendor and spectacle. We found out on Saturday, sadly, that Clinton elected not to pardon Peltier. Leonard Peltier, of course, the Native American who was framed by the FBI for the murder of two FBI agents who, according to at least some accounts, was more likely shot by somebody native to that particular area. Peltier was somebody who had come in from outside. He was a Native American from another part of the country who came in to try and help cool things down and keep people safe. He was framed for the murder. And Clinton put off until Saturday decision on who he was going to pardon and not, and he did not pardon Peltier, which is a great disappointment, I think, to any progressive activist, hopefully to all progressive activists out there. But, you know, I think I can understand why he didn't.
Why?
Well, I would personally be afraid for my life if I were Clinton.
And the FBI was so opposed.
And the FBI was so opposed to clemency for Peltier that they were demonstrating a historical first for the FBI to take out public ads in newspapers.
Full-page ads,
and to demonstrate in the street against clemency for Peltier. You know that there's strong feelings in the FBI, and you know that there's only one other organization in this country that is more likely to shoot you on sight, and that would be the CIA. That would be more likely to get away with it, but the CIA is more of an overseas operation, and the FBI is more domestic. So they're probably the most fearsome domestic agency, and... you know, we just have to wonder. There have been rumors of FBI complicity in the Martin Luther King shooting, and we certainly know that they framed Leonard Peltier. They stopped at nothing in order to get somebody for the murder of those two agents. They don't care whether Peltier did it or not, as long as they got somebody. And if I were Clinton, you know, maybe he figured that he wanted to stay in, I mean, from everything he said, he wants to stay involved in politics, and he wants to continue working on the progressive issues, or so he says anyway. And perhaps he figures he'd be taken out if he pardoned Peltier, and that he'll be more effective by not doing it. So I can cut him a little slack on not doing it, although I'm terribly, I know, Gordine's looking at me like, Nancy, how can you do that? But I'm terribly disappointed. Terribly disappointed.
Well, he did take care of his own things. Clinton took care of his own little stuff.
He pardoned his brother.
Yeah, there were other people that he pardoned. There was a Native American local to New Mexico, wasn't there, that was pardoned? I saw on the news last night there was a man that was pardoned. I'm sorry, I don't recall if he was Navajo.
I'm not aware.
I'm not quite sure. Oh, thank you so much. Peter McDonald, our engineer here, Paula Inglis, tells us.
Oh, Peter McDonald.
Former Navajo president. Okay. Well, Gordine, what are you saying?
Well, yeah, Peter McDonald. I remember I had a friend who covered a lot of stories about Peter McDonald.
Oh, is this not like
a long time?
Is he not a progressive?
He was a tribal leader.
Oh, so he's one of the people who was sort of.
I don't want to say without checking some of the data, but I do remember a dear friend of mine, Susan Landon, doing a lot of coverage.
So if you had to draw a line on the side, he'd be on the opposite side from Peltier?
Let's just say Clinton should have pardoned Peltier.
Yeah, would have been nice. Oh, my. All right, enough about the inauguration. Hey, I want to mention something. You know, there's a organization called the West Montana Gay and Lesbian Community Center. And they have a very nice website. I've been the last few days going back through emails dating back as old as like a year or more that have been sent to me here at Gender Talk, and taking care of some long overdue business. And Ann Harris from GayMontana.com wrote and points out that she wanted to put a link to Gender Talk on her site. And I went and found the link. It's a very nice link. She says nice things about us. And she also mentions that she makes tapes of Gender Talk available at the library. And I think that's absolutely
nice.
Terrific. And we
that's
really
great.
Appreciate you doing that, Anne, making Gender Talk available for more people. Thank you so much for doing that.
And we encourage others to do that as well. If you have the if you can get it from the web and then put it onto tape and distribute it as far as you can.
Yeah, if we had the resources to do it, we would. We don't have them, and so we certainly welcome anybody who wants to help distribute Gender Talk, please. Be our
and
guest.
And send the royalties to Hal Fuller at, sorry.
Yeah, right.
Nah.
All those copious royalties. The only thing we ask is let us know what you're doing. Please, we do like to be sort of kept in that loop a little bit, and we sure appreciate knowing that folks are out there listening to us. I think we'll go to our question of the week. You guys ready for that?
Sure.
All right.
It is this week?
All right. Well, we missed it last week. We didn't do any questions. So we're going to try and get through a few questions. I've got a few here lined up for us, hopefully with quick answers. First, a comment. This is from Christine in Medford, Massachusetts, who says, I was listening to last week's question of the week when someone asked, why me? Well, I came across a quote that I would just like to share with that person and everyone else, too. The quote is, the shoe that fits one person pinches another. There is no recipe for living that suits all cases. And she attributes this to Carl Jung. So, Christy, thanks for that quote.
And Carl Jung was like a pioneer in psychotherapy.
Yeah. Is that right?
Psychoanalysis.
Yep. I know he's famous. I've heard his name a lot.
Psychoanalysis.
Much more mystic than Freud.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, his wife, Emma Jung, contributed the whole concepts of the anima and the animus, the idea
right?
of the woman within the man or the man within the woman.
But popularly, everybody knows Carl Jung, but people don't talk
Emma
about
actually
Emma.
Wrote the book.
No way. I love it. You heard it here first on Gender Talk. Gordine McKenzie. here's a question. Dear Nancy, I'm a pre-op transsexual living full-time since I was 17. I'm now 35, and I don't know if I really want to have surgery. I'm very passable, so work and boyfriends and family haven't been a problem, but I just don't know why I'm hesitating. I don't know what's wrong with me. This is from Belinda in Sydney, Australia. This one, by the way, is at least a year old, so my apologies to Belinda, who's probably had the surgery by now. But
Nancy, you should answer this since you're kind of...
There,
yes.
Yeah, well, I think this one's really easy. There's lots of good reasons for not having the surgery. There's nothing wrong with you for not having the surgery. If you feel like hesitating, you absolutely should. The surgery hurts a lot of people. I'm not saying that the surgery is bad. The surgery is not bad, but it's extremely risky, and a lot of people end up seriously damaged. And you got to ask yourself, do I really want to take that risk? And a lot of people don't. More and more people are opting not to have the surgery. And the more that society loosens up its restrictions on gender and behavior, the more it accepts natural diversity of gender, then the less necessary it will be for social reasons to have the surgery.
And occasionally within the community itself, there's a lot of pressure to go ahead and have the operation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that pressure should be rebelled against at every turn. Karen?
I was just going to say, well, if you're passable and you're happy and your boyfriends are accepting you and all that stuff, it's like, who cares?
Exactly. Especially if your sexuality is working. If you're able to be sexual and have pleasurable sex, I would not put that at risk. Because if you have the surgery, you stand a 50% or better chance of losing the ability to have satisfying sex, okay, to have orgasms during sex. Those are the numbers. So, Belinda, I wouldn't be in any big hurry. Here's the next question. I was raised in a fundamentalist cult, Jehovah's Witnesses, which believed that the world would end in 1975. So much for that belief. Everything was in black and white, good and evil, male and female, etc. The leaders ruled against trouser suits for women using Deuteronomy 22:5. Could my transvestism be a reaction to all this?
No.
My first comment, if they were wrong about the world ending, why assume that they're right about anything else?
Yeah, in fact...
I mean, that's a biggie. If you're going to miss the big ones...
Yeah, it seems to me that there's as much pain caused by fundamentalism as there is...
And we know everything's not black and white. There's all sorts of cool colors in there.
Yeah, exactly. I would say that your transvestism may well be a reaction to it. What difference does it make? Your transvestism is an exploration of other ways of being, other ways of dressing, other ways of thinking and feeling about yourself. It's a healthy response to a world that tends to be overly abridging of our freedoms. You should enjoy the freedom to dress however you choose and to inhabit whatever gender role you choose. Make the most of it. By the way, this is from Diane, who also says, just found your show. It's excellent to hear transgender and radical issues discussed and explored in such an intelligent and informed way. It gives me great encouragement to come to terms with my transvestism as a strength. So, Diane, thanks for that.
Progressive.
Yeah, obviously she's talking about you, Gordine.
No.
No comment.
Yeah. Anyway,
I've got one thing to go out to Diane. Could your transvestism be a reaction to all of this in the sense that barriers and limits that other people try to place on you is a challenge? Yeah, it could be.
Yeah. Well, and why we make the assumption by labeling certain behaviors as deviant that they're deviant and we don't look at other behaviors. So why is it transvestism that's being looked at? What about the people who are doing the labeling? Why don't we look at their behavior and go, deviant?
Why don't we look at people who insist on dressing?
What the heck's wrong with them to label it deviant?
Only on wearing pants all the time. That's the only thing they're allowed to wear, and they're never allowed to wear lace. Like, what the heck's the matter with those people?
And I don't understand anybody... wearing a tie, something that you can be easily strangled with.
That's why it's there, Karen. It's a symbol of subordination, and it's that's why it's a requirement in corporate culture.
Well, no, those symbols have changed, you know. At
just
one time,
having fun, folks.
The red tie was a way for persons of the same sex to find each other in New York in the late 1800s. Yes, 1800s, early 1900s. It's the way that gay people found one another.
With the bandana in the back pocket.
Now it's changed to, like, power dressing in Washington and Republicans and Democrats.
Anything else on this question?
Anyone in a black tuxedo is cruising.
Thank you, Hal. Words of wisdom from Hal Fuller.
Anybody in a black tuxedo is probably a waiter.
All right, our next question, and we're going through some questions quickly tonight, folks, because we're doing a little bit of catch-up. Here's another.
Mayonnaise.
A lot of these questions, by the way. Jeez. All right, that does it.
Just seeing if you're awake over there.
Some of these questions are actually fairly common. We get variations on these a lot. You know, am I really a transsexual? Why am I cross-dressing? Is there something wrong? You know, those sorts of questions. Here's another one, a variation on one that we get a lot. I've been on hormones, Premarin and spironolactone specifically. My question is that my sexual orientation has changed from hating men to needing one. I'm confused. Is this normal? This is from Allison in Rhode Island.
For you, yes, it's normal.
Allison in Rhode Island.
I'm going to say, don't fall into those women that say, I need a man, and they take anybody, and then they're beaten to death.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. That's a really important one, because actually, that happens to transsexuals a lot. Mm-hmm. You're probably, as a transsexual, you're probably more at risk than anybody else in the culture, unless you're a white transsexual, in which case you're less at risk than a transsexual of color. But you should be careful, and you should be discriminating in terms of being careful about who you choose as a partner.
And needing a man for what?
Well, for sex, obviously. What else?
Well, what kind of sex? I mean, this could be a very complex question here.
Well, that's a good point, isn't
it? You know?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk in the transsexual community about orientation, and for some people, transitioning sort of gives them permission then to be with men. And for a long time, there was a theory that transsexualism was really a response to
repressed homosexuality,
that a person born male figures if they become a woman, then they can be with men and it'd be okay. So maybe there's tiny little grains of truth in that, but of course that was used to denigrate transsexuals
and gays.
So that got
blown apart because of the wide variation of sexual preferences within the trans community too.
So there may be some grains of that in your allowing yourself to be with men, but there's probably and the hormones may free up something in you to let that happen. But chances are there was some amount of that in you before you ever took hormones, before you ever acknowledged yourself as transsexual. You probably had some amount of attraction, but in this culture, that kind of attraction is stigmatized so intensely that it's understandable that you might not have been aware of it previously. So I would guess that that's probably the most likely explanation, that you had some amount of latent attraction to men that wasn't obvious to you until you began taking hormones.
But attraction is different, too, than needing one. We have to be careful about those things, as Karen cautioned.
Let's talk more about that, needing versus attraction.
Women are conditioned, in worst-case scenarios, to dedicate their whole life to finding their man.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about this real quickly at work. It's like if you're a certain age and you're not married and you don't have children, people stare at you like there's something wrong with you. Like me being 44, not married, I don't really want to get married. I don't really want to have kids either. And people look at me like,
what's the matter with you?
She's a freak.
No, you're not. You're an Amazon warrior, Karen. Great.
All right. I think that'll do it for our questions, unless there's any more comments. Thanks for that one, Karen. And thanks for your questions, everybody. That last one is from Allison, Rhode Island again. You can send your question to question@gendertalk.com and take heart. We went through three questions this show, and we'll get to your question, or we'll do our best. So do send it along, question@gendertalk.com. By the way, you're listening to Gender Talk on WMBR in Cambridge. Joint production of KUNM Albuquerque and WMBR Cambridge. The views and opinions presented on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT. They are strictly ours. And now it's time for Hal Fuller.
And the Gender Talk, Twisted, Nasty News. Boom, 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 boom. Hi there.
Hey there.
Hi.
Hello
there.
Who?
Story from Salem, New Hampshire. Police are investigating whether there has been any illegal activity at Sullivan Street parties in Salem, quote, where couples can trade partners and engage in group or private sexual acts. The so-called swinging parties held at that address, which is referred to as the Love Shack, according to the Northeast Swinger website, have frightened and annoyed neighbors, according to police and town officials. The parties are hosted by Brett and Danielle Penny, according to police and those same officials.
Why the parties have frightened? I can see parties annoying neighbors.
The neighbors were kind of jerks. They had there was this house that they would have private parties in, and they would, the only way I guess they announced it was through their website.
Right.
Yeah.
So people would come to the house, and
there was a $40 contribution asked at the door, and at one point there was as many as 20 to 28 cars on the street, which does change the nature of the neighborhood.
That's a good business. You can live off of it.
Hey,
we have a big living room, girlfriend.
Hey.
So the neighbors got all bent out of shape and told them that they couldn't have parties anymore. So they said, okay, we're selling the house.
Yeah, they're thinking about moving at this point.
Well, I don't blame them. I mean, if they want to have that kind of party, why shouldn't they be able to? You know, if people didn't want to have this kind of party, people wouldn't show up at this kind of party. You know, it ought to be okay to have parties like that somewhere. And why not in one's own home? You know, as long as one keeps the noise down to where...
And it's like, why are these people that aren't going to the party meditating on who's sleeping with who in the house?
I guess I can see why it might be annoying to have 20 or 30 cars parked, you know, outside your house and along the street and everything.
Yeah, on a regular basis, if people were having parties of that nature in my neighborhood, I would probably be upset just because there wouldn't be any parking space.
Yeah.
And that would be noise.
Yeah, I would say that if it's a residential neighborhood that doesn't have provision for that, that maybe they should get themselves a place that has more parking. You know, why not? Well, get a house with
a... it's not morality, it's parking space. I mean, everything boils down to parking space, doesn't it, really, in the urban environment? Sorry.
Well,
in Boston, parking.
Yes, yeah, it's different out here.
In this overcrowded world, it does come down to how much we infringe on each other's space, doesn't it, a little bit?
Yeah. Well, here's a story from Portland, Oregon. In public ceremonies to honor Dr. Martin Luther King, the prestigious Mayor's Human Rights Achievement Award for 2001 was presented to a Portland transgender rights activist, Lori Buckwalter.
Hey, Lori. Mm. Congratulations.
Mayor Vera Katz, in personally presenting the award, cited Mrs. Buckwalter's work on the recent changes to Portland's civil rights ordinance to include gender identity protections and her work for the rights and safety of all the citizens of Portland.
Yay.
Good stuff.
Yeah,
she's done great work.
Congratulations. Congratulations, Lori. Good work.
And a story from Brisbane, Australia. After two men were kicked out, forget the accent, out of a public park for kissing, gays and lesbians and their non-gay allies saw only one way to respond. The great kiss-off, quote, unquote. About 100 people turned out to smooch it up with the partner of their choice at noon on January the 14th at the South Bank Parklands in Brisbane, Australia, a park operated by the Australian state of Queensland. A spokesperson for the National Union of Students, Mark Pendleton, told the Australian Associated Press of the trigger incident, it was just a kiss. There wasn't any groping or anything like that going on.
And we sometimes a kiss is just a kiss.
Right. We think the gay couple should have the same rights as heterosexual couples. We don't see South Bank Parklands kicking out heterosexuals that you see in the park. You get the general idea.
I love it.
Yeah.
Of course, the spokesman did for the park administration did say that they would wish heterosexuals as well as gay and lesbian couples had been asked to tone down public displays of affection.
Bye.
Thank you, Karen.
What is that, Karen?
What are you singing?
There's that song. It's like, you must remember this.
A kiss is but a kiss.
Yeah.
A smile is but a smile.
I was trying to do background music to Hal's story.
That was lovely.
It was absolutely wonderful.
Thanks. Well, we think that's an appropriate response. Definitely kiss in.
You know, and that's a big issue for so many same-sex couples who don't feel like they can openly display any affection to one another.
Yeah. I mean, that's an issue. I mean, I feel uptight about that sometimes. It's like, sometimes I feel really relaxed about it out in public, and sometimes it's like, oh, my God, is somebody going to
get
us a hard time?
Are we going to get killed?
Yeah, we're going to get our butts kicked.
There is that possibility.
Yeah, well, we have been chased a little bit and threatened a little bit in Oklahoma and a few little things like that.
Exactly. So it's not like we don't have reason to think that.
Yeah. Well, that one. Your Oklahoma story. First, they, you know, kind of made fun of you, and then they asked if they could join in.
Yeah, that's typical. We get that.
Typical.
Well, here's a story from Caracas, Venezuela. Faced with death threats and conspiracies, Venezuela's government says it is now threatened, mind you, by 140 pairs of multicolored women's panties mailed to the country's top brass. An insult which has riled feminists in that country. Sent by post to the top military officers over the last few weeks, the mystery undies have the South American Republic generals up in arms. Short arms. Sorry.
Short arms?
That's a slang term for genitalia, dear, of the male variety.
Really?
You didn't know that?
No, never heard it before.
You don't read all the right books, do you?
Books? Who reads books?
No, but I think that's a really effective protest. But women groups did slam the government, saying that the generals were a symbol of their own prejudice by accepting the implication that women's underwear was a symbol of cowardice.
Which
is rather strange.
You know, maybe that's what we need to do, is a little bit of gender terrorism in order to sort of highlight how people are so messed up about gender. You know, it's amazing how little things like women's panties can throw people into a furor.
Yeah.
Or into a frenzy, huh? Sorry. The moment you've all been waiting for, the final story because we need to move along. The ultimate form of safe sex has been developed by an Australian inventor. Lots happening down in Australia, apparently. Dominique Choi, C-H-O-Y, has applied to patent his design for a virtual reality sex doll. Quote, a lifelike flexible mannequin covered with imitation skin, powered by tiny motors to respond to a user's touch or to signals from a partner delivered via an internet connection. I'm sure that AOL is working on it. Virtual reality headset would allow partners to see each other and could be programmed so that the partners would resemble famous actors or pop stars, according to the journal New Scientist.
You know,
wow.
It's inevitable.
We've
had inflatable dolls for how long? So it's just inevitable that at some point somebody's going to try to make a robot doll. But can you imagine in 100 years from now when, you know, they've made all these incredible advances in all this stuff and they can actually do that? They could actually make a viable doll that is the same size and appearance as your partner, and you and your partner, separated by many miles, could Gordine's making these horrible faces.
Yeah, I feel like making them too. It's like these people need to get out more.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it. What if it keeps some guys from going out on the streets and harassing women to have something like that to play with?
Oh, what if it,
isn't that a,
what if it makes them go out on the street and harass women more?
Do you think it does?
Twilight.
There was a Babylon 5 episode where they had that kind of setup, but the problem was that it was shorting out. The suits the people were wearing were shorting out while they were enjoying themselves. So it got really nasty. And that's it for this edition of the Gender Talk Twisted Nasty News. Not virtual, real and live.
Thank you, Hal. Thanks.
I
have to ask Gordine a question.
Yes.
Yeah, do we know, like, is anybody, there's been this debate for so long about pornography and the effects of pornography, and we know that there are certain effects from pornography, but having a surrogate, for example, having masturbation devices, this is sort of an extension of that. It's just a more sophisticated masturbation devices. You implied that would, you know, maybe cause more people to go out on the street seeking the wrong kind of sex or the wrong kind of relationship. Do you really think
if
that's
you had something made up that was like your partner, then that would not be a real person responding to you. That would be someone responding to your desires, and it wouldn't be two people really coming together and working things through.
So sex would take a whole different turn then.
Yeah.
Instead of it becoming about two people getting together, it could take it in a whole different direction where it's about one person getting satisfied, and it could become, it sounds like, you know, the world, I mean, there are so many singles in the world, and the world in some ways is becoming more and more of a singles place, certainly in this country.
I'm not saying anything against masturbation. I don't think
like it might tend to increase loneliness.
But to make something in an image of someone else.
Well, but discard that. I mean, let's say it's not an image of somebody else in particular. Let's say it's a Barbie doll.
But that also associates with women, and it gives us a particular idea and attitude about women.
Right.
We can't divorce the two.
I mean, eventually, it prevents that person from having a relationship with a real woman.
Yes.
Because the Barbie doll, you know, real woman can never do what the Barbie doll is going to do.
I've got a penis on my Barbie doll.
How do you have a penis on your Barbie doll?
She does. I've seen it on top of your refrigerator, right?
Yeah.
All right.
I cross-dressed my Barbie.
Okay. Speaking of which, I think it's time to do our announcements. What do you guys think?
Moving right along.
Moving right along. It's been fascinating, guys. let's see. It's time for announcements with Amanda Hotpoint and Karen Larson. Take it away, guys.
Okay. Hit it, Amanda.
Okay. Here's what's happening.
For the week of January 22nd. Tonight at 9 p.m. on the Lifetime channel on cable TV is a movie, What Makes a Family, which is a true life story where Brooke Shields is going to portray a lesbian who had a child with her partner and got involved in a court battle for custody. That's at 9 o'clock tonight on Lifetime Cable.
There's a Fetish Flea Market number 16, a two-day event, January 27th and 28th, at the Rolling Green Ramada Hotel in Andover. And for info, call 617-864-0655. And I guess that was extension 3.
Mm-hmm. American Boys will host its fifth annual True Spirit Conference in Washington, D.C. from February 16th through the 19th. You can email Mike Sanders at whoby1@aol.com or call 410-392-3640.
February 20th through March 11th, Dame Edna, the Royal Tour at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. For info, call the Wilbur box office or Ticketmaster at 617-931-2787.
And SGI USA Rainbow Lotus Group is GLBT Buddhists, which holds their bi-monthly meetings to practice and study Buddhism. For information online, it's proudbuddha@hotmail.com, and we don't have a phone for them. And call us at 617-253-8810 if you've missed anything.
But wait until we're done the announcements.
Good point.
Connecticut Outreach Society annual banquet is Saturday, March 3rd at the Colonial Inn and Banquet Center, Bridge Street, East Windsor, Connecticut. And for info, you can call 860-604-6343 or email ctoutreach@aol.com.
And the Transgender Scholarship and Education Legacy Fund, known as TSELF. The International Foundation for Gender Education, IFGE, will be awarding numerous scholarships to transgender-identified students in the helping and caring professions. These include, but are not limited to, social services, health care, religious instruction, all denominations, teaching, and the law. They seek to reflect a broad range of interests. For information, contact the IFGE at P.O. Box 540229 in Waltham, Mass., 02454-0229, or call them at 781-899-2212, or online at www.ifge.org. And that does it for the announcements.
All right. Thank you guys for that. Those, by the way, announcements are compiled by Karen Larson. Thank you, Karen.
Why, you're quite welcome, everybody.
Why, you're welcome, Miss Karen Larson. Well, aren't you gracious tonight?
Why, thank you, miss.
It's Karen's Hollywood voice. I like it.
She's feeling her oats, I can tell.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of oats, I think we have our first first and only guest for tonight. This is... We're very, very excited about this. Gurdine, you want to tell us about this?
And we rarely do this. Every once in a while, we come across a person that is doing a number of different things, and we decide to dedicate the whole time to interviewing them. And tonight, we're going to have one of the world's most influential theoretical ecologists who is challenging the way biologists think about sex. Join us and talk about a new book that she's writing on evolution's rainbow, which explores gender and sexuality in invertebrates. And she transitioned to living as a woman in 1998. Welcome to Gender Talk, Joan.
Hi.
Hey, Joan, welcome.
Okay, thank you.
How are you doing tonight?
Oh, just fine.
Great.
Good.
Well, it's a beautiful day here in San Francisco. It's just lovely.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it's been overcast all day here. We only get 3 overcast days a year here in Albuquerque, but we don't get to choose which ones they are, and today was one of them.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. But they just had snow in Boston, so at least we're lucky we didn't get that. So let's see. Should we start? There's a few subject areas here. Should we start with just, you know, get the transsexualism out of the way and then move into the ecology and all that fascinating stuff and the more theoretical stuff?
Sure.
So you're somebody who grew up as a male and you transitioned a few years ago. Did you have, how did the transition go? Did that go all right for you?
Well, it went pretty well. I transitioned quite late in life. I was,
how old were you?
I was about 52 when I did it. And so I've lived quite a while as a male. and I transitioned at on the faculty at Stanford University. There are, in fact, two transgendered people on the faculty at Stanford.
Really?
The other is female to male.
That's so
and,
cool.
So there are two of us at that conservative bastion, of all things. And it was quite a surprise to everyone. And at the time, Condoleezza Rice, who's now becoming quite famous in connection with the new Bush administration, she was then the provost. And so what I did was to make an appointment with her. And I remember quite vividly sitting in a church that's across the quad from her office until my appointment came. And when the time came, I walked over there, and I had a little letter with me, and I had some pictures of me as Joan. And I sat down, and I said, I have something very personal to discuss. And she looked at me and said yes. And so I gave her the letter, and then she read it very quickly and decisively, the way a CEO does. She went chunk, 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 paragraph by paragraph. And at the end, I reviewed what I had done at Stanford and basically asked permission to remain on the faculty. And she looked at me and said, yes, you may remain at Stanford.
I love it.
So, of course, she could have said no, and but she did say yes, and actually put me in touch with someone who was then an associate provost with her, named Anne Fernald, who happens to be a psychologist working in developmental psychology of voice and sound acquisition by babies. And Anne was very interested in all of this and became a very good friend. And one of the first things she did is she took me to a women's clothing store so that I could get clued in on what it was okay to wear as a woman faculty member at Stanford, because there is, of course, sort of a corporate dress. And so then because I came out at the top level of the administration, in a sense, the approval of this kind of filtered down. And so the provost's office briefed the deans, and then the deans in turn briefed the departments. So from an official point of view, the transition went fairly well. And then I went away to Santa Barbara for a year and did the on sabbatical and did the physical aspects of the transition there.
What a nice place to do that.
Oh, it was. It was just great.
Yeah, Santa Barbara's gorgeous.
And so then I came back to Stanford and the year before this year. So so last year was my first full year at Stanford as a woman. And so I'm in the thick of trying to make a new life and trying to develop new relationships with people and all of that.
Good for you. That first day, of course, the first day when you step back as Joan, I mean, I remember the first time I walked onto the job as Nancy, and it's like, you know, your heart is pounding and you're all butterflies and just like you just hope everything's going to go well, and then gradually things start going okay and you get to relax a little bit and be yourself.
Yeah, you do eventually. It's very disorienting to come back. I mean, you know, the institutions never have any mechanism in place for how to welcome you. In principle, you're a new faculty member and you ought to be welcomed as though you were a beginning assistant professor in some ways, but that doesn't happen, and so people just sort of stay back and kind of watch from a distance to see, you know, what's going on, and in the meantime you feel fairly isolated.
I remember sitting once at the wedding of a friend and thinking, gee, you know, there ought to be some kind of ceremony, some kind of rite of passage like this for people who transition in gender in this way, that it would be nice if there could be some kind of ceremony to which you can invite all who know you so that you could then do some kind of formalized process and give everybody a chance to kind of be there and to celebrate the change and the passing.
Oh, I really agree with that. And,
that'd be a great idea.
I'm on a committee called the OASIS Committee, which is part of the Episcopal Church's outreach to gay, lesbian, and now to transgender people here in San Francisco in the diocese here. And I've been trying to get them to spend time and to commit effort to developing a liturgy for coming out and a sort of a liturgy for affirmation of identity.
That would be, you know, Joan, that would be, I think, so welcomed and so healing.
Yeah.
What a great idea and what a good thing for you to promote.
And, you know, the American Indians did precisely that.
Yeah.
And so in our day and age, we just need that. And, you know, all kinds of people could take advantage of this. It doesn't...
There's a lot of ways of coming out, and there's a lot of issues to come out about.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Terrific, Joan.
And if something were put into place like that, you could really come out. It wouldn't be like kind of half coming out or feeling like you're not quite there or some people just are always going to ignore you or it would be a full
it would be a community
recognition.
Sanctioned thing.
Yes.
Yeah,
we need it. We need it.
Okay, Joan, we'll work with you on it.
All right. No, I think that's a great idea because there aren't any rites of passage. There aren't any rituals. And those things are important in life to signify a change.
Exactly, yeah. Hal. Thank you so much. Joan, that's Hal Fuller, by the way.
Okay, great. Hi.
Okay. So, all right, we've talked a lot about transsexualism on this show. We've talked with a lot of people about how things go, and we know that there's ups and downs and good and bad. And let's touch briefly on how you've been accepted in your profession, and then let's talk about some politics and some ecology and some of the work you're doing, okay?
Okay.
Does that sound good? So let's, first of all, you know, professionally, there's listeners out there who are wondering if they can come out to their family and to the people they work with. They're wondering if they do come out, will they lose their jobs, whether they are gay, lesbian, transgender, or whatever, whether they subscribe to a particular religion that's maybe they think might be frowned upon. Can you tell us about how your associates out there, you're known far and wide for your work. Can you tell us what kind of response there's been?
Well, among my colleagues, it's been phenomenal, and I've just really discovered such goodness in people that I really didn't know was there, honestly. I suppose before coming out, in a way, I had been living in a shell, and once I came out and sort of put myself out there, I discovered this incredible wellspring of support, and I'll never forget the letters of support and encouragement that poured in from all sorts of unexpected sources around the world, it was a wonderful experience. And you know, before you come out, you have all these fears, and you're just consumed with the imagination of devastating scenarios, and I found that that they didn't happen, that the fears were worse than the reality by far.
Yes, common experience.
And I remember thinking, and I expected to be disowned basically by ecologists, and even though that had been has been an area where I've done a lot of work, but I'm not really, although I am an environmentalist, I'm not really identified as a figure in the environmental movement in the way that people who are regularly reported in the newspaper are. And so I felt that, though nonetheless, I thought that ecologists wouldn't want to have anything to do with me because the last thing we need is to be accused of being a bunch of commies, queers, and so forth, you know. And so I felt in some sense that the environmental movement might be endangered by my coming out. And yet that turns out to have been an absurd fear. And so, and of course, the women faculty in ecology and evolution turn out were very, very helpful right away. And you know, when you first come out, you know that you're cutting loose all your bonds to the past. It's like a ship that's leaving port. You know you've left the dock, but you don't know if you're going to be allowed to pull into any other port.
Exactly.
And yet people are there to take you in. And I think the initial stages of the whole transition are relatively easy. I think that now, not for everyone, but I don't want to, you know, overgeneralize, but at least for me, they have been. And I think that what I'm dealing with now is not unlike what anyone deals with who has to just make a new life, because it still does come down to developing new relationships, having new romances, and new career paths and things. And so making a life is hard for anyone.
Exactly.
But you do have to do that. And so and you hope that during the course of transition you don't burn too many bridges, because the transition phase is over in a couple years, and you do have to get back to the you know, real human business of making a life.
Exactly. You get back pretty much to the same point you started out from, except without the baggage of the unfulfilled need.
Right. Yeah. And the inabilities of being able to, you know, you can't function terribly well when you're presenting in the wrong gender.
I was reading, I think, a New York Times article talking about you some, and how people around you have commented that you seem a happier person, a more relaxed person in your work environment, more likely now to opt for consensus over a more aggressive approach in terms of moving forward in whatever you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, in that regard, you know, it really is sort of a win-win situation. I mean, I found, well, as you know, we're always invited to talk about our inabilities in our previous gender presentation. And so I did the best I could as a male. And
that's very endearing, dear.
Yeah. You know, I'm forgive me for interrupting. I'm known as a rude host, but I have to say you have such a gracious manner that I'm sure that was an ingredient in your success, and that might be something that's worth noting for anybody out there who plans to come out about anything, you know, that a certain amount of graciousness goes a long way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. It's good stuff. Yeah. Really great stuff.
I think I read a quote that you said it became clear to you that you weren't ever going to figure out how to do the guy thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Isn't that annoying?
Yeah.
Well, here we think we're smart and all that. You can't figure something out like that. That's so basic.
Exactly.
Makes us wonder what gender is.
Yeah, exactly. It makes you wonder how the culture has contrived gender such that we feel so disenfranchised sometimes. Let's talk about your, well, you know what? Let's take a really short break here for a special announcement, a special message that we need to do, and then we'll be right back. Okay, Joan, don't go away. You're listening to Gender Talk.
Okay.
Je ne veux pas travailler.
Je me lève et je te bouscule.
Il faut se lever tous les matins.
Elle est belle comme le matin.
Paris se lève.
10h du mat, j'ai des frissons.
Oh no, another Monday morning and you have to get up. Well, wake up and smell the croissant. Every Monday from 6 to 8, we bring you French Toast, 2 hours of the best French language music, concert reports, and news of what's going on around town. We also do ticket giveaways and we play your requests. So listen to French Toast every Monday morning from 6 to 8, right here on WNBR Cambridge.
Bonjour, Joan, we were just talking about how we figure out how we do the gender that we do, and you're working on a new book right now about gender, and do you apply your own situation when you're thinking about the certain way that we're supposed to be or that we're living? What is it that makes us gendered?
Well, it's... You know, obviously it's a big issue.
Big question. Yeah. Yes, I was just thinking that.
The book,
what's the meaning of life, Joan, while we're at it?
Yeah, okay. Here we go.
As you all know, I have a cold, so I have to ask big questions all at once.
Well, the book is all about gender and sexuality in invertebrates, you know, the animals with backbones who are our closest relatives.
In vertebrates, not in invertebrates.
That's right.
Okay.
Invertebrates.
Yeah.
And
okay.
So it draws on examples, of course, from fish and from reptiles and from birds and from mammals, and then it grades on into the expression of gender and sexuality in people. And it's really it has two parts to it. The first, the biology part, in a way, is to lay on the table how much diversity in gender and sexuality actually exists. And
in nature, you mean, in the animal kingdom?
In the animal kingdom, yeah. And okay. So it turns out that the extent of the variety is not well known, and I'm not aware of anybody who's done a survey of it in recent years. And as a biologist, I knew that findings were coming out over the last 10 years, but I really hadn't looked into it very systematically.
Uh-huh.
And it's really astonishing what's being found. And
we've talked on this program with Bruce Baugemiel,
yes.
whose work I think you're familiar with.
I am.
Biological exuberances.
Yes.
Yeah.
And of course he's focusing specifically on same-sex courtship and same-sex genital contact in the course of courtship usually, but the whole idea of sex and gender is even bigger than that. And one of the things that emerges early on is that there's a lot of sex changing going on. And first of all, you have to get clear whenever talking about this stuff, what biologists mean when they define sex. And sex just turns out to be, or that is, male and female turn out to be simply gamete size. So by definition, any individual who
what? Makes... What was that? They turn out to be...
Gamete size. And so
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, a gamete is an egg or a sperm.
Right.
And by definition, the egg...
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
So the size of your gamete, the size of your thing that helps reproduce determines your sex?
Yes.
Really?
That's definitional. So
if I have big gametes, I'm a woman. If I have little gametes, I'm a man?
That's it. That's all there is to it. And it's really anticlimactic, given all the, you know, the centuries of poetry defining what love and valor are.
I'll say.
And it all it comes down to is the size of your gamete.
My gamete's bigger than your gamete.
That's right. By definition, therefore, if an individual changes sex the way fish change sex, it means they're actually changing the size of the gamete that they make.
Mm.
And that's all there is to it.
And this happens out there in nature? Actually, there are animals out there that change the size of their gametes?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, on coral reefs, if you just strap on a face mask and go diving on a coral reef, probably half the fish you see have changed sex.
Really?
Yeah.
It's
very, very common. And they change in both directions. In some cases, that is, there are some species that go from male to female, others that go from female to male. There's still other species which are simultaneously male and female. And there's still, it now turns out in the last couple of years that there's some species that crisscross where they go from male to female and then back to male again.
I love it. Well, what great experience they must garner.
Yeah. They really have it all. And, Now, that's actually different from changing gender, because even if an individual keeps making the same size of gamete through time, there can be different genders, so to speak, with which the organism expresses their own sexual identity.
So gender, as you're using it, is more about how the individual comports themselves.
Exactly.
Rather than a physical attribute.
Exactly. Right. Okay. And how it can be translated into the entire physicality of the organism as well. So there are lots of species in which there are two or more types of males, three or four, or two or more types of females. More typically, multiple types of males.
So more than two sexes is what you're saying, essentially.
No. There will be two males in the sense that they both make sperm, but they'll be entirely different, not only in the way they comport themselves, but even in their anatomy.
So there's multiple genders, then, within the male population.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
And so you wind up being able... So while there's typically just two sexes in the sense of only two gamete sizes...
Well, it's like we have Pee-wee Herman and Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, there you go.
Great.
So this whole idea of widening the concept, the definition of gender, to include the way an organism expresses their sexual identity, leads then to... the idea that you can have a great many genders, maybe four or five, even though there are only two sexes.
Fascinating.
And, it really is, because...
I see instant applications to humans, of course.
Yes.
You bet. And then this sort of gets to some of the other things I know you folks are interested in, because you can then look at the way that biologists describe these phenomena, because these are really surprising things to turn up. And the biologists actually writing about them usually use value-loaded and pejorative words for them.
Oh, don't
this
they?
This is so fascinating, because this flies in the face of the claim that it's not natural.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like this is an area of study of primary importance towards the way that we view ourselves in gender and in sex.
Yeah. It really does. And...
This is going to have the church going crazy. This really puts science at odds with the church, doesn't it?
Well, maybe. There's certainly some churches it does.
Thank you. Okay. And, yeah, I didn't mean to imply there's only one church.
And some of them are lighter on their feet than others.
I like that. That's very good. We like the ones that are lighter on their feet.
Yeah.
The ability to change is more likely then, huh?
Go with the flow a little bit. Cool.
And so... So I'm going into a lot of this, a lot of this phenomenology about the way gender and sexuality are expressed, and I'm not really pushing any theories of my own about it. I think the agenda that we have is to get it all on the table.
Exactly.
And because there's a lot to chew over about all of this, and it is pretty surprising. I mean, this is not the way nature was supposed to be.
Joan, do you think a lot of this information has been suppressed since so many medical and clinical writings are, as you suggested, soggy with moralism?
Yeah, it's hard to say whether it's been suppressed exactly. I know that the biologists are often quite embarrassed about what they find. Biologists usually identify with the organism they work with to some extent. Like, as you know, I work on lizards.
Oh, I love it.
I'm a total lizard chauvinist.
Is that right?
Are you?
Yes. I mean, lizards are the closest thing to God. I mean, let's...
Well, you're speaking to someone I named my business after a lizard. Yeah. I was like, this is great.
Oh, yeah. We're big on lizards.
Yeah.
So, if someone lizard. Has... if someone then finds that their organism is gay, they don't really want to admit that. What, my organism gay?
Fascinating. So they find some other way of dealing with it, some other explanation?
That's right. So they beat around the bush, or they don't even report it fairly often. And so to say it's suppressed is maybe a bit strong. To say that it's underreported, though, is certainly true.
How about denied?
Fair enough. And...
Our simplistic reality, our simplistic structures of belief require a certain amount of denial, especially in areas like this.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's what's happening over in the biology realm, is that it's
fascinating stuff.
People are kind of owning up to this now. And of course, people who are out gay scientists and transgender scientists obviously have a big role in helping bring this out. And Bruce Bagamale's book, you know, really is, I think, a major step forward in that regard.
I do too. Yeah, that's how we felt. We're looking forward to seeing your book.
Yeah, it's a great thing to write. And now the other aspect of the question, though, concerns the role of medicine. And now here things are much more delicate. And as I do think that medicine is suppressing information about diversity. And
how so?
I think that medicine as an institution historically has pathologized diversity.
Oh, for sure. Lock people up for wrong gender or any behavior that's deemed not normal.
Or turn hermaphrodites into freaks.
Right.
And
the thing is that, and it's a little hard to understand, there are social reasons why, of course, medicine wants to assert control and avoid diversity and avoid embracing diversity. But another problem is that medical doctors often just don't know much about diversity. The training that pre-meds have is very limited and very focused on biochemistry, so that they may have only heard, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but they may have only heard of five organisms in their life. Rat, snake, goat, monkey,
guinea pig,
you know, and that's all sometimes they seem to think is out there. And so we have a real problem that the medical profession is being looked on by the general public to enunciate the state of science and to enunciate what's normal and what isn't normal, and yet it's the very peer group that's had the least amount of training in what biological diversity is.
Not to mention the politics of normality and stigmatization.
Exactly.
Yes.
Now, and the politics of normality and stigmatization has, I think, been increasingly well addressed in the social science literature.
Yes.
But
the
contribution that I am hoping that I can make is to point out how scientifically inaccurate medicine is as well.
Good.
And, you know, to go at it from that side.
Fascinating. Now, in the area of gender and sex in particular,
Definitely.
Yeah.
As you know, there's a long history of human abuse, which has been basically foisted on people by medical recommendation. And there's a long history of involvement of medicine in socially repressive causes, not the least of which is, of course, Nazism and eugenics and things of this sort.
Yep.
And the real problem is that medicine, so far as I can tell, does not have any objective definition of what a disease is, and that to state what's healthy and what's sick is actually a statement of valuation and not a statement of science.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So it's not simple.
No.
What you're saying is it's not simple to say what's healthy and what's sick, especially when you talk about the form a person's body might take, the form of their gender or sexuality.
Right, right. They're pretty clueless on this. And in the book, I've quoted some neat examples of this.
Could you give us one, Joan?
Well, for example, the whole idea of circumcision.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, where there at one time it's medically necessary as a matter of health to get circumcised, and then they turn around and vote that it's not medically necessary after all, and then 2 years later they vote that it is medically necessary.
Really? They went back and forth?
Back and forth, yes. And this is just in the last 5 years.
No way. So are you telling me that I didn't realize this was going on. We did a show on circumcision, but it's been about 5 years since we did it. It sounds like we need to revisit the topic. I thought that the consensus was that it wasn't medically necessary. You tell me they voted that it is medically necessary now?
Yeah, it's back in again.
Oh, there's,
and I can give you the citations on
if it's medically. If it's medically necessary, how did the human race survive this long?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is really, I mean, it winds up being almost a throwaway line from an ecologist's point of view, because I remember talking about this in a talk I gave last summer, and I said to the ecologists I was speaking to, now, imagine a species all of whose males have penises that require surgical correction.
Wow.
And the idea is preposterous.
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
Of course.
You never could evolve because you don't have surgeons when you're starting out.
Right. Yep. And so it's ecologically and evolutionary ludicrous to suggest that all males need circumcision.
What about, here's a question for you. What about transsexualism and SRS? There are a lot of people out there who equate the two. There are a lot of transsexuals who feel that because they have a cross-gender affiliation or identification, that they require the surgery in order to cross-live. What do you think about that association?
Well, as you know, many transsexuals, really latch on to the medicalization of the way they are. I mean,
it's seductive in a way, because then there's a cure.
Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to explain. The path of least resistance, if you're trying to justify yourself, and hopefully one doesn't try to do that, but if you found yourself in some situation of trying to justify yourself to someone else, simply to say that you have the sickness of gender dysphoria, which is cured by SRS. But this is falling into a line of discussion which really isn't necessary at all, and is self-pathologizing, and you give up a lot for that.
I think that you're so right, and I think that you mentioned one of the key points here in the way that we determine between healthy and sick in that model. When we say sick, there's always some implication of a cure, and no matter what cost that cure is, it's something that's going to be practiced upon what is considered not healthy.
Right.
And that becomes problematic. Joan, you're also doing some thinking and work about our gene pools and biotechnology. How does that link into all of this?
Well, where that comes up, it follows off. It follows from the issue of what's healthy and what's sick. And what's going on now in biotechnology is that a lot of techniques of genetic engineering are being sold to us as cures.
Yes.
And so the question is whether there is something sick that these cures are curing. And especially if it comes to genetic aspects of gender and sexuality.
And that's all you hear on the radio when they talk about, this gene work, gene splicing, gene mapping, all this. They're going to cure this, they're going to cure that.
Right. You know? And so the question is whether what they think they're curing is a sickness to begin with. Mm. Now, here it gets a little technical because it looks pretty clear that a number of the so-called diseases that they want to cure are more complex than they look. And the background to this is that if you really do have a genetic disease, it's going to be extremely rare, because if it is a disease, then it's being eliminated by natural selection continuously.
Yep.
And so it only resurfaces at a very low frequency in the population, like about 1 in 1,000,000. And if you pick up genes like the gene for sickle cell anemia, which is present more like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100, then It can't be solely a disease. And as we know for sickle cell anemia, it actually provides protection against malaria. Now, if you were somehow to remove the gene from sickle cell anemia from the population, you would actually cause more harm in the aggregate than you would mm-hmm. help, because all the people who are then going to contract malaria would contract that, and the size of that pool would exceed the size of the pool of people who are currently suffering from sickle cell anemia.
That's pretty scary.
Joan, forgive me for this, but
yeah.
for oversimplification, but doesn't it boil down to the fact that the human body and the world as a whole is a very, very complex system, and that we're being sold simple solutions that aren't true solutions?
Yeah, exactly. You didn't oversimplify at all. I mean, the idea that you can cure disease by just plugging in a new gene is going to make as much sense in 10 years from now as the idea of drilling a hole in your head to cure a headache.
Yeah, exactly. Or the idea of bloodletting to cure disease.
Yes, it's totally simplistic.
Yeah, it'll be another one of those things.
And it's a real danger, because we're getting so much hype for biotech now that it's reminiscent of the hype we were getting for nuclear energy about 20 to 30 years ago, where you're getting people basically in white lab coats telling you that trust me, this is in your best interest.
Well, this is the entrepreneurial engine that drives our economy, mm-hmm. which is everyone's desire to cash out their stock options and get rich with their startup company, and so they oversell the new technology in order to stimulate investment and drive the stock price up.
Well, I mean, that's true, too, but there's also...
I guess that's the side of it I saw.
Yeah, I mean, but there's also the patriarchal, if I can use the phrase, scientist as an authority that's going on here.
Daddy science.
Yeah. And that, I think, is the aspect of it which is most similar to nuclear energy, is that the nuclear physicists were godlike and putting these power plants everywhere. And as a result, we have this stockpile now of nuclear waste that pollutes our desert floors in various places. Now, we can easily get the pollution of the human gene pool from the introduction of genetically modified people. Now, we already are having the pollution of the gene pool for corn. This has already happened.
Oh, that's right. We've had all these reports about genetically altered corn and all of that. How do you... Are those...
It's not loose.
Is that a real risk to us? Is this going to be like people who objected to the automobile, which pollutes the air, but, you know, is maybe not as dastardly as people thought, or maybe it is? Or is this a real terrible danger to us, you think?
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, the point is they didn't know. The gene that has escaped in corn, and in wild corn now, is feared to cause allergies in some people. I don't personally know whether it does or not. But what's happened is that the agro genetic companies that release this are trying to get the definition of the allowable level of this gene changed.
Yeah.
And so what it comes down to is that the gene has escaped. And so the gene pool of corn has now been polluted by this. And if we're lucky, it won't do any harm. But
sounds like we're in for a generation or so of genetic mutation, I mean, much as is being depicted in some science fiction now, anticipating a lot of genetic mutation in the near term.
Yes, but I mean, I think this is the environmental crisis of the future. Well, you might even say of the present. That it's one thing to pollute lakes and streams and all of that, but now we're also talking about the possibility of polluting our gene pools, which is the last pristine area of the environment left, so to speak.
Yeah.
And
scary stuff.
Yeah, and I think this really, really needs to come to the attention of conservationists, that we need to conserve the diversity of our gene pool as well as the diversity of ecosystems.
God. Joan, we're down to just a few minutes left here. I definitely wanted to, you know, hear how you did on the election, and also I wanted to give you an opportunity to take us anyplace else you wanted to go today.
On the election, as you know, I ran for supervisor here in District 6 in the South of Market District of San Francisco.
How'd it go?
Oh, it was fabulous, just fabulous. And I'd moved to the city, and I was trying to meet people and make a new life. And I came out in the middle of a large field of 17 candidates, came out with 2.5% of the vote, which was right
good for you.
Dead in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's with an expenditure of less than $1,000 altogether, including $500 for the filing fee. And
good for you. Excellent.
The people, you know, who are really players in this were spending, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. And as a result, I made lots of friends and anticipate serving on some city commissions and being part of the city government here.
Excellent. So you achieved your goal of getting more involved.
Yes.
Congratulations.
And transgendered people were really active and overall all across the political spectrum around here, and also both F to M's and M to F's. And so during the course of the campaign, a number of us were also able to connect with one another, and there was a caucus that got going called the Transgender Political Caucus, which also helped focus a number of the trans issues.
Excellent. Excellent.
And so, yeah, it was really good. And so then I could speak to trans issues by referring to their research, basically. And I didn't have to be anecdotal about my own experience.
Like, good.
Well, you know, they say 70% of the trans people are unemployed, and this is a problem, you know?
Excellent. Joan, that's great. A great connection that you've made, and it sounds like you are putting yourself in the good service of the not just the transgender community, but the greater community as well.
So diversity from the gene pool and diversity in the political arena.
Joan, is there anything else that you wanted to mention tonight? We will surely have you back. We'll hope to have you back, at least if you'll agree to do it.
Oh, I'd love to.
Yeah, we've certainly been enjoying talking with you. Is there any place you wanted to go that we didn't have a chance in the minute you've got left?
No, not really. I mean, I'm just very excited about the improving identity and self-awareness and pride of trans people.
Yeah.
I think we do have to stay together and that we really can pull it off. There's a lot of support among the straight community especially, and it's increasingly feasible to develop alliances with the gays and lesbians in our efforts. And I just think we have to keep our act together and keep connected and keep moving forward.
Excellent, Joan. Well, you know, when people of your stature come out and speak so eloquently towards these issues, you move us all miles. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thanks so much for getting in touch with me.
It's very much our pleasure. Gordine is in a paroxysm of coughing over there. She's unable to speak right now. So on behalf of Gordine, I'm going to thank you for being our guest tonight. Joan, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Absolutely fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it was.
Wasn't that great?
It was really good.
So impressed. You know, it's really, it's a thrill to meet a person who has transitioned, who's transgender in one way or another, whether they've transitioned or not, but someone who's really embraced diversity of gender and who is also a world-class scientist or world-class in any regard, but just somebody of such stature who puts all that at risk in order to be true to themselves, true to their gender, and then also puts himself in service of increasing our culture's appreciation of diversity. So kudos to you, Joan, for that good work.
Kind of blown away by the fact that I wrote 5 books and over 120 papers.
yeah.
in academic journals. It's like, whoa.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This person, she's definitely, very highly thought of around the world. Like I say, we had a New York Times article, a copy of a New York Times article that said she's one of the leading authorities in ecology, which is no small field. So there are things we could have talked with her about. She's done work on ecology and economics. I mean, she's just a very fascinating person, and sounds like she'd be willing to come back again. So we'd sure love to have her back again and talk some more. It's great stuff. That does it for our show. I'm not sure who we're going to have for you next week, folks, so we'll let you know next week. And in the meantime, coming up in just a couple of minutes on WMBR and Cambridge's Dreams of a New Age, so don't go away. Our website is www.gendertalk.com. Please check out any of the over now 200 programs there for your listening pleasure, including a very fine program with Joan Roughgarden that you just heard. You can email any of us here at Gender Talk, Nancy, Gordine, Hal, Karen, Amana, at gendertalk.com. That's our email address. Our site host is Transgender Forum, tgforum.com. Thanks, guys. We appreciate you hosting guys and gals, although guys, of course, is not gender specific. But thank you for your generous hosting of our archive. Gender Talk is a joint production of KUNM Albuquerque and WMBR Cambridge. Please join with us and thank them for the use of their fine facilities, and here at KUNM, the generous support of their staff. That does it for our program tonight. We hope you've enjoyed our show. We sure enjoyed bringing it to you. On behalf of in Cambridge at WMBR, Hal Fuller, Karen Larson, and Amanda Hotpoint, and in Albuquerque at KUNM, Paul Ingalls and Joe Warnes, and of course, Gordine McKenzie and myself, Nancy Nangeroni, thanks again for listening. And remember, no matter what the occasion, Gender Talk is always appropriate. Good night, everybody.